This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 6, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandes. US officials have now made public the first details of their plan for an interim Iraqi government. After the last deadline for immigration registration, community alarm over the numbers who went in to register and never came back out, in an FSRN exclusive, we speak to some of the detained. And South African freedom fighter Walter Sisulu dies at 90 in his home in Johannesburg. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Jackson Allers, and these are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Secretary of State Richard Armitage arrives in South Asia to meet leaders in India and Pakistan as a noticeable thaw between the countries gets underway. Bina Sawa reports from Karachi, Pakistan.
Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee's recent unexpected offer of a hand of friendship to Pakistan and Pakistani Prime Minister Jamali's telephone call to Delhi broke a 17-month deadlock between the two nuclear-armed neighbors, just days ahead of a visit to the region by the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State. From accusations and counter-accusations, both sides are now vying to restore full diplomatic relations, as well as the road, rail and air links that were snapped in December 2001 following an attack on the Indian Parliament, for which New Delhi blamed Islamabad. Although India and Pakistan both loudly deny that external pressure is a factor in their sudden bonhomie, observers say that neither wants to be caught on the wrong foot, particularly as far as Washington is concerned. India has always rejected third-party mediation, while Pakistan wants to avoid accusations of harboring terrorists. This is Bina Sarwar, reporting from Karachi for Free Speech Radio News.
France and the United States are to cooperate in a study on the use of biometric techniques to prevent forgery of passports and other travel documents. Zinat Hansrod reports from Paris.
This agreement came at a one-day meeting in Paris of justice and interior ministers of the G8 countries. The ministers agreed to press ahead urgently with the development and use of biometric chips, that is, the use of personal data such as iris scans, fingerprints and facial measurement, as a near foolproof means of checking identity at international border crossings. The G8 ministers also discussed measures to clamp down on the financing of terrorism and organized crime. They issued a statement saying that the threat of the Al-Qaeda network remained serious. The meeting was also attended by the U.S. Attorney General, John Ashcroft. He became the most senior U.S. official to visit France after the breakdown in relations between the two countries over the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Ashcroft, however, did not take part in the press conference alongside Nicolas Sarkozy, a French interior minister. According to French diplomats, Ashcroft was given instructions from the U.S. presidency not to talk to the media in Paris. This is Zinat Hansrod in Paris for Free Speech Radio News.
In its latest ruling criticizing the Texas criminal justice system, Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court vacated the confession of a Houston-area teen made during an arrest without probable cause or a warrant. Renee Feltz has more.
Harris County Sheriff's investigating the 1999 murder of Destiny Thetford obtained a confession from the victim's brother, Nicholas. In his testimony, he implicated 17-year-old Robert Kaup. Lacking evidence or motive, police were unable to obtain a warrant for Kaup's arrest, but this didn't stop six officers from going to his home in the middle of the night. He was then handcuffed and taken into custody, where he confessed to involvement in Thetford's murder. But the Supreme Court said yesterday Kaup was presented with no option but to go and ruled his arrest was illegal under the Fourth Amendment. Kaup's case is set to be heard again by Texas courts later this year, this time without the confession. In Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Felt for Free Speech Radio News.
A new study released in Canada concludes that the country's newspapers present incomplete and misleading information about new prescription drugs. From Toronto station CKLN, Kristen Schwartz has more.
The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Canada's leading researcher on social and economic issues, examined coverage of Celebrex and four other major prescription drugs. Their study analyzed all 193 articles about the drugs published in 24 Canadian daily papers in the year 2000. All articles mentioned benefits of the drugs, while nearly 70% did not cite any possible harmful effects. Less than 5% of articles mentioned contraindications, those conditions under which it is not safe to take the drugs. In some cases, reporters cited spokespeople for patient groups or academic researchers without identifying their financial relationships to drug manufacturers. The study included a journalist's guide to covering prescription drugs and urged media and medical professionals to make quality information available to the public.
That report was filed by Kristen Schwartz from Toronto. And those were the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
EU Commissioner for Development and Humanitarian Aid, Paul Nielsen, is in Iraq today. He's the first top-level EU official to visit since the US occupation of the country began. And while the EU maintained it wouldn't willingly pay for the reconstruction of Iraq if the US failed to obtain United Nations authority for war, it appears that the world's biggest aid donor is now keen on getting involved in efforts to rebuild the war-torn country. This on the heels of an announcement today by USAID, the government body charged with divvying up the reconstruction contracts, that a $2.5 million contract to run the three largest commercial airports in Iraq was awarded to Skylink, a US company with close ties to the Department of Defense. While the contract is initially worth $2.5 million, reports say it could increase to $10.2 million over 18 months. And while the spoils of war are divvied up among the victors, as Naja Middleton reports, US officials have now made public the first details of their plan for an interim Iraqi government.
President Bush announced today the appointment of former diplomat Paul Bremer as the top civil administrator of Iraq. Bremer was responsible for US policies to combat terrorism for a few years in the Reagan administration. He has also worked for Kissinger Associates, a consulting firm headed by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Bremer is expected to arrive in Baghdad next week and to oversee the formation of an Iraqi government. Meanwhile, retired General Jay Garner, until today the sole U.S. administrator of Iraq, announced that Iraq's interim government would be headed by a council of about 9 members, representing exiles and locals from across the religious and ethnic spectrum. Garner also identified 5 men that would probably be part of what he calls the nucleus of an Iraqi government.
Ahmad Jalabi is supported and financed by the Pentagon, while Iyad Alawi by the CIA.
Independent journalist and longtime analyst of the Middle East, Lamis Andoni.
The Kurdish groups are different. So although they work with the Barzani and Talabani, especially Talabani, he is the Pentagon's man in Kurdistan, they do have a power base in Kurdistan. That's not true for Jalabi and Iyad Alawi. The fifth group is the Supreme Council for the Shia Council led by Hakim. It has a strong power base among the Shia and it opposes American occupation.
Andoni believes the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq is dealing with the reality of occupation and trying to influence the shape of the Iraqi government from within. But she says that it, like any other group that cannot accept the U.S. political and economic agenda for Iraq, will drop out or be excluded by U.S. authorities. Garner expects the nucleus of an Iraqi government to appear in May during what he called a make-or-break month. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials have reportedly said that a small number of detainees at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base will be released this week. The administration came under increasing pressure from human rights groups and the home countries of some of the detainees when it admitted 2 weeks ago that boys as young as 13 were being imprisoned as so-called enemy combatants. Human rights groups such as Amnesty International are demanding their immediate release and are calling on President Bush to publicly condemn the use of torture by Guantanamo interrogators. Press reports have pointed to U.S. officials condoning interrogation techniques that include holding detainees in prolonged painful positions and denial of food and sleep. Vienna Colucci is international justice specialist with Amnesty International USA.
We welcome what appears to be a positive step forward in resolving the situation, but we're looking at the broader picture and remain concerned about the more than 600 prisoners who remain in Guantanamo in essentially what is a legal limbo. What we're calling on the U.S. to do is to guarantee that all the prisoners' cases, and not just those who are affiliated with allied countries, receive a fair trial or are released.
Colucci is also worried upcoming trials of some Guantanamo prisoners before military commissions will not meet human rights standards for a fair trial. The reported number of detainees to be released vary between 13 and 30. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has said the process of sorting through detainees is complicated and takes time. For Free Speech Radio News, with Kata Mester, I'm Naja Middleton.
Today is the first day in what could be more than a month of congressional debate over the 2004 energy bill. Congress is still busy debating the Bush plan for tax cuts in the hundreds of billions of dollars, and Democrats presented an alternative tax model. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
The energy bill is always contentious because it has such an effect on industry and workers and the environment and regional economies. And now there's a whole new concern for national energy security. Those in government who are heavy with industry money argue that nuclear power and increased domestic drilling is the safest way forward. Environmentalists, consumer advocates, and some Democrats argue security could come from increasing fuel efficiency across the country's energy infrastructure and moving away from the oil standard toward renewable sources like solar and wind and biomass. New Mexico Senator Jeff Bingaman.
The lack of an effective renewable portfolio standard in the bill as it now comes to the Senate floor, in my view, is a major flaw. And renewable energy will not get a fair shake unless there is some pressure from us for that to happen.
A coalition of green groups and consumer advocates were ready this morning with an alternative proposal to the energy bills moving through the House and Senate. At the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, a consumer group founded by Ralph Nader, Naveen Nayak deplores the House energy bill supported by the president, and he's not much happier with the Senate version.
The fuel economy standards doesn't actually make our automobile vehicles any more efficient, and it provides the first ever tax production credit for clean coal, supposedly clean coal, which will only result in more and more asthma problems and death from air pollution.
Tax incentives in the Senate energy bill go mostly to traditional, more polluting industries, but it would also have the federal government doling out some $30 billion in loan guarantees to build six new nuclear power plants. Once those plants were online, Naveen Nayak says the federal government would be empowered to buy the power back.
Our federal government is going to be subsidizing nuclear power, and to do that, they're going to be taxing payers twice. It's going to be a double taxation, once to build the plants and then a second time to buy back the energy.
The bombshell of the day came in an off-the-record briefing when a staffer for the Republican-controlled Senate Energy Committee said drilling in Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is not going to be part of the energy bill. He also said plans for encouraging Native Americans to start producing energy on their lands could lead to an expedited nuclear power plant permitting process, one that states would have less control over. The energy bill and its amendments could be on the Senate floor for more than a month. Meanwhile, debate continues on the president's tax cuts. Bush wants $726 billion in tax cuts over 10 years, mainly to the wealthiest Americans. Today, Senate Democrats presented a tax cut plan they say is focused more on working people and which would cost the Treasury much less, about $152 billion over 10 years. Taxpayers would see most of the savings in the Democrats' plan in the first year, Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle.
These tax cuts will save a family of four, making approximately $50,000, $1,630 this year. We provide $40 billion in immediate assistance for state and local governments. We extend unemployment benefits for nearly 4 million laid-off workers.
Over in the House, the New York Times reports that a pension bill by Ohio Republican Rob Portman and Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin would let companies reduce retirement payments to their blue-collar workers because those workers, on average, don't live as long as others. Companies would not be required to pay as much into blue-collar workers' pension plans on the assumption that they die sooner than other employees. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, The Capitol.
2 days after the U.S. announced the end of its military war against Iraq, all attention moved to Syria. Secretary of State Colin Powell paid a visit to Damascus over the weekend to tell Syria that it's being watched. Analysts see Powell's visit as a final warning to Syria to abandon what Washington sees as a policy of harboring so-called terrorist cells and supporting extremist factions. The U.S. is serious, analysts believe, and this leaves Syria with few options. Ul al-Farawati reports from Amman.
If Syria follows through the American demands of cutting support to any Iraqi officials and cooperates with rebuilding Iraq, including the creation of a democratic government, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said, then that tells America one thing about Syria's decision to move forward, that Syria is looking for a better relationship with the United States. If it does not, Powell added in his trip to the region, then there will be consequences. On the other hand, Many here in the Arab world believe the motive behind the U.S. rhetoric towards Syria stems from Syria's vocal opposition to Israel. Mawfaq Mahadin is the managing editor of the Jordanian independent Al-Wahda Daily.
The situation in Syria is very complicated. We cannot predict the future, and we cannot depend on what is being said in the newspapers. What the Syrians say in their media does not necessarily reflect their political tactics. But I know for sure that it is Israel.
The world was divided about the purposes of the American-led war on Iraq. Many believe the U.S. was after Iraq's vast oil fields. However, the case is different in Syria, a country that does not enjoy any abundant natural resources and relies on imports from neighboring countries like Iraq. Again, Mahadin, a leftist, says Syria derives its political clout from other sources.
The Syrian policy is founded on what is termed as politically manipulative in its territory. It gets its political power by weakening the regimes surrounding it.
Mahadin refers to the Syrian support of Jordanian opposition, Lebanon's Hezbollah, and Palestinian Hamas. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell told Syrian President Bashar Assad that his support of terrorist groups, including Harbor Palestinian organizations engaged in terror attacks against Israelis, makes it hard to move forward on the Middle East peace process. This, according to Jordanian political analyst Jamal Tahat, is a must because Syria has a history of changing alliances.
Because Syria is very tempting target. Weak militarily, weak economically, and crippled politically. At the same time, it's easy, it's soft, and appealing in this regard. The Syrian regime actually committed all possible mistakes since mid-70s until now. Maybe Syrian regime is not different from the Iraqi regime at all. With one factor, he's less bloody than the Iraqi regime. But the same structure, the same mentality, the same slogans, the same approach, and the same conception for state and power and leadership.
Analysts believe Damascus has to act swiftly to deflect American warnings that the country is on America's list. The key, many in the Middle East say, lies in Syria's transition from a dictatorship into a democracy. If Syria does not comply with U.S. demands in the region, then many observers predict the so-called regime change in Iraq will repeat itself in Syria. Powell repeated his earlier warning to President Assad that unless specific progress to halting support to what he termed as terrorist groups could be demonstrated, Syria could come under sanctions under the 2001 USA Patriot Act, as well as under a bill pending in Congress called the Syria Accountability Act. However, in the minds of many Arabs on the streets, there is no question that the Bush administration is keen on taking advantage of what has happened in Iraq and in the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
While Palestinians are living under the Israeli occupation, American and European diplomats are continuing their efforts aimed at promoting the so-called Roadmap Peace Plan in the Middle East. Yesterday, the American envoy William Burns held a meeting with the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen after a first meeting with the Palestinian Legislative Council Speaker Ahmad Khoury. Awad Dwabes has more from Ramallah.
One of the main clear objectives of the Roadmap Peace Deal is the creation of a Palestinian state by the end of the year 2005. The Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said his government would agree to the principle of a Palestinian state if Palestinians would abandon their United Nations mandated right of return to their homes and lands which they were forced to leave. This position was refused by Palestinian Legislative Council Speaker Ahmed Qri'a Abu Ala after his meeting with the American envoy William Burns. This provision is among 15 conditions that the Israeli government have with the so-called Middle East Roadmap, a map that is creating totally new terminology in the Palestinian dictionary. In the U.S.-backed roadmap's third phase, the plan calls for a, quote, fair, just, and reasonable solution of the refugees question, a question that is often at the center point in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But the Israeli government didn't give yet an official response to the proposed roadmap outside of releasing the 15 objections. The Palestinian population is confused in the dark between promises of the creation of their own state and the nature of such a state. Abir is a teacher in Jerusalem.
I don't think that it is the state the Palestinian dream to have or even would like to have. It might be not in 2005, even after 2010, after the finish of the period of Sharon and those people.
Rana, who works in a local company in Ramallah, thinks that a Palestinian state, as the bakers of the so-called roadmap are describing it, would serve only the Israeli interests.
What Israel is looking for is to control that state, to create a state which fits their own interests, and not to let Palestinians to be independent. I don't think that we will have a final resolution with the roadmap. Americans are supporting Israel. Israel is supporting America. What America wants is what Israel wants.
And once again, Palestinians feel abandoned by the international community. Though an independent Palestinian state is still a dream for them, many are questioning the real motivation behind using the term of a state. Dr. Abdel Karim Abu Khashan, a university professor, considered that what counts for Palestinians is what kind of a state they will have, even as they are in need of real peace.
What kind of state? What's the shape of this state? It's not a matter of state itself. It's how can we have this state with the sovereignty. We need the peace more than any people in the world. We are suffering from the war. The propaganda is shaping us as the criminal. We are the victim twice. We are the victim of the criminals and we are the victim of propaganda.
And once this reporter asked the question whether Palestinians accept or not the roadmap, the answer was emotional. Raja is a student in Bir Zeit University outside of Ramallah.
The situation is so confusing. It's too hard for me to answer this question. But let me say it this way. Deep in my heart, I won't accept the roadmap. But reasonably and logically speaking, I will accept it. This is all that we can do. There is one single superpower, which is the United States, and it will do what it wants.
Confusion, loss of hope, and the continuous hard daily life. Today, six Palestinians were injured in Tul Karim and Hebron, and the Israeli army destroyed five more houses in Jenin and Bethlehem. And even as the U.S.-backed roadmap is shopped around, many Palestinians are only hoping for a fair and just solution of their question. Amaud Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
On the heels of last week's Supreme Court decision giving the Justice Department the full authority to indefinitely detain immigrants who are waiting to be deported, concerns are rising in immigrant communities across the country as news of the newly detained emerges. On April 25, nationals from Ethiopia and Indonesia were required to report for the program of special registration, and many never came out. Simba Russo has been investigating the cases of some of the detained and files this FSRN exclusive.
I went to register myself at the Federal Plaza building at downtown New York.
Yudi Franciscus, a 27-year-old from Indonesia, was only following procedures which led to his detention. Male nationals from Bangladesh, Egypt, Indonesia, Jordan, or Kuwait were required to show for the ongoing special registrations now required by the Justice Department since 9/11.
It took me 3 hours just to get in the building because the line was so long. And some people were already in the Federal Plaza since 1 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the morning. The first interview I went for 20 minutes and then I wait for about 4 hours, for the next 4 hours before they call me to the second interview. The first time he called my name, he asked me to take out all the possessions that I have in my pocket, just like everything. And then my wife asked him, you know, how long it's going to take, you know, how long the interview is going to take. And he said he's going to let me out about 6:30 to 7:30, so which is like 3 hours or 2.5 hours. That's what he said.
For the past 2 weeks, Yudi has been held at the Elizabeth Detention Center on charges of crewman deserter. According to the INS, Yudi had a deportation order to leave the country in June 2000. Left without any rights, it is up to the deportation officer to send Yudi back to Indonesia.
Very quickly, the Justice Department lined up the INS
as the first customer for CCA.
Political analyst Judy Green explains how this will benefit CCA.
Now, the INS will pay anywhere from $40 to more than $100 a day, depending on the level of services, to house their detainees in local jails. The average per diem payment from the INS is now $75 a day. CCA, which has operated detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey, since 1997, gets $150 a day for housing INS detainees.
Whether or not Udi will be deported within the next few weeks is solely dependent on his deportation officer, a CCA employee. As of now, the officer seems apprehensive about making any decisions, although a voluntary departure has been signed and a ticket for Udi has been presented. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Simba Russo.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi.
South African freedom fighter Walter Sisulu died yesterday at the age of 90 in his home in Johannesburg. Born in 1912, the same year the African National Congress was founded, Walter Sisulu went on to become the deputy president of the ANC. At age 15, Sisulu left his home village of Transkei and went to Johannesburg to earn money for his family. Sisulu spent many of the following years involved in trade union activism, and in 1940 he joined the ANC. With Nelson Mandela, whom Walter Sisulu had encouraged to join the ANC, the two founded the ANC Youth League in 1944. A few years later, they were running the organization itself. During the 50s and early 60s, Sisulu served seven jail terms. In 1961, the ANC took up armed struggle and Sisulu went underground, delivering weekly broadcasts via a clandestine radio transmitter from a farm on the outskirts of Johannesburg. Eventually, he was arrested and held in solitary confinement for 88 days. Then in 1964, he and others, including Nelson Mandela, were sentenced to life and imprisoned on Robben Island. Sisulu was released in 1989. He was 77 and had spent more than a quarter of a century behind bars. While Sisulu was known as the quiet man of the struggle to end apartheid, he was one of the greatest fighters for black freedom, and his life today is being remembered as an inspiration to South Africa and the whole world. For Nelson Mandela, Sisulu was someone who stood, quote, head and shoulders above everyone at the ANC. Mandela spoke about his friend and mentor at Sisulu's house in Johannesburg.
He leaves behind a stunning example of the qualities we need in order to live in the community. And I know of nobody as remarkable as himself.
Walter Sisulu died at 90 years of age. We go out with the music of South African musician Hugh Masekela. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFT in Houston, Texas, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our interns are Susan Chelly and Christopher Martinez. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.